Hello and welcome again to 92.6 FM. This is Verum Sport, where each and every Saturday between 6 and 7 o'clock, the team behind the award-winning Verum Sports will analyse, dissect and debate some of the key sporting topics and themes. And as always, we're not plucking these themes out of the ether. Remember, it's your show, every single bit, as much as it is ours. And each and every single week, these debates have come from you, the loyal Verum Sports listener. So remember, keep engaged. Really, really looking forward to this one. As I say, it's only a few weeks now until the return of the Premier League. Only feels like 2 minutes since it ended. But of course, it is that famous transfer window. And this week, we are going to be dissecting, analysing, pulling apart what we consider to be the best and also the worst transfers in Premier League history. So as always, thank you for this suggestion. Looking forward to getting into it. But as we know and as you appreciate, it's your show every single bit as much as it is ours. And we're grateful for you, all your input. And I know, as always, keeping the man, the legend that is our very own machine, Jason McKenna busy have been you across social media. Good evening, Jason, and as always, what on earth have we got from our social media followers in terms of transfer flops and transfer heroics?
Well, I tell you what, Tony, this year's silly season could be sensational if we see Messi coming to our shores. That could be one of the greatest transfers of all time, but it's not happened yet, so we can't include it in that. But yes, on social media, people have been getting involved left, right and centre. In fact, this has been a really popular topic. We've got Nigel. He said the best transfer has to be either Shearer or Aguero, both magnificent strikers. And listeners will know that you and I always wax lyrical about Aguero there. Michael has actually hurt me quite a lot here. He's mentioned Ashley Cole for $6.7 million, a steal at the time and still sickening for Arsenal fans. Michael, yes, indeed. It still hurts me to this day for $6.7 million as well. That has to be one of the best transfers of all time. Then Coutinho, Rian has said it's the best signing because it's the made the most money. I can't argue with that logic there. That is very strong. And Annie has said Bergkamp, Kompany and Keane were all great, but CR7, arguably the greatest of all time, for $17 million to Manchester United. Now, that's business. The worst ones, Richard has said Alexis Sanchez. Andy has also said another Man United flop, Angel Di Maria. Harry's mentioned Ali Dia, which, you know, if you don't know the story, we might get into it a little bit later. But that's
We will. I love this one. I love that one. No doubt we're going to bring that up at some point.
Then we've got Father Tim. He's messaging and said, the worst, most heartbreaking transfer ever was one for me personally. As a Tottenham fan, Gareth Bale was sold to Real Madrid. And then he's not being played by Real Madrid at all. So he was taken from Tottenham and hardly played. I kind of see that one there. And then Peter has probably said two of the most, you know, synonymous with poor Premier League transfers, Torres and Carroll, both poor businesses from Liverpool and Chelsea there. And I have to agree with you, Peter. What were the two clubs thinking? Do you like any of those shouts there, Tony? And is it bringing a bit of nostalgia as well?
It is fascinating. I mean, look, it's not an exact science, this world of transfers, is it? And we'll certainly bring up that Ali Dia one later on. Don't want to do too much of a spoiler, but one of those in that last bit of social media interaction that you've referenced there, Jason, I'm actually going to be bringing to the piece as my own personal worst bit of business. But even the great Alex Ferguson, for all the great buys that he's made, you know, you think of a Veron as well, a Taibbi, so many that didn't make the grade. So even the greats don't bat a perfect 1,000 when it comes to the transfer window. Some great shouts there. As you rightly say, Jason, we are always on board when it comes to Aguero. And oh, goodness me, as you say, not yet done. But the prospect of that Argentine pairing up with another great Argentinian in Messi is, I ball poppingly exciting.
Mouth watering.
Absolutely. So watch this space. Some great shouts there. I love the Shearer one, of course. And again, you know, he went from Southampton to Blackburn, where he did win the Premier League, then famously to Newcastle, remains the all-time top scorer in the Premier League history. I wonder if maybe, though, maybe, does he wish maybe he had another transfer in him, perhaps to claim more silverware? That's another conversation for another time. The history of the Premier League, though, is awash with world-class buys, world-class buys on paper that didn't work out. And now we are going to get underway, kicking things off with what we consider to be the biggest flops. And before I go to your particular choice in that category, Jason, just want to give a big shout out to the amazing Graham Griffin, the voice of the Saints. And make sure you check out the Radio Verum website all season for commentary on the Saints home matches provided by the voice of the Saints, Graham Griffin. And also, first time this week, and it was awesome, the new local football show every Tuesday, 7 o'clock. Check it out. That's anchored by the legendary Graham Griffin. So big respect to him always. Can't be with us here, but he's got involved. He's given his thoughts and his thoughts for the worst signing in Premier League history. I think was also cited by one of our awesome Twitterers. And he's gone for Andrei Shevchenko, coming from AC Milan to Chelsea. And back in 2006-09, I mean, you can't fault the decision on paper to bring the great Ukrainian in. I mean, he was the Ballon d'Or winner in 2004, only the third Ukrainian in history to claim that title, previously done by Oleg Bolotkin and Igor Belnogov. And he claimed the Champions League with AC Milan in 2003, and was a runner-up in Champions League again with Milan between 2005 and also again in 2008. And, you know, AC Milan are one of the prestige teams in European football. His 176 goals for them makes him the second most prolific goal scorer in AC Milan history. Only Gunnar Nordahl has more. So on paper, with pace, power, could score from outside the box, inside the box, not bad in the air too. Can't fault the acquisition, but a huge money signing. And between 2006 and 2009, only played 48 games for Chelsea, only claiming 9 goals. Not really the result that anybody at Chelsea were expected. In fact, the results, you could argue, made the Blues blue. Your thoughts there on Shevchenko?
Yeah, I think Shevchenko was a great example of what was going on at Chelsea at the time, and arguably it cost Mourinho his job. And I think it's one that you would probably look at very negatively because of your love for big man Mo. But yeah, it's a great example there of Roman Abramovich kind of becoming the manager himself. You know, him stating to Mourinho, you have to play this person. And that's what they had the huge falling out over. You know, The previous season, Mourinho had blitzed the league. He revolutionised how we played in Britain. And to actually lose one of the best managers of all time, arguably Chelsea's best manager of all time, even at that point, you know, because Chelsea hadn't, let's be honest, had the most illustrious history, and then came Mourinho with the best defence ever in Premier League history. He was about to make all sorts of records. He may have even done the unbeaten stuff. And to have that taken away just because of a disagreement over a player, just because he liked him, it just absolutely shows you how ridiculous the club was run at the time. And Jose Mourinho probably did the right thing to say to Abramovich, no, I'm not going to play him, because that's going to make him look stupid if he doesn't do well. But yeah, it's a very confusing and wrong transfer, I'd say, as well, to kind of force that upon a manager. And maybe as well, it was kind of sad to see it from Shevchenko's perspective, that it kind of ruined a great legacy. You know, one of the other aforementioned people that one of our great listeners put in is Torres, somebody else who ruined their legacy by going to Chelsea. And I think this has been a long-term Chelsea problem with signing strikers. They haven't found somebody to replace Drogba. They even had to bring back Drogba to replace Drogba for a little bit. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a long kind of standing shadow at the club. They've done great with wingers. You know, Hazard came in, he was their best player for a while, but we haven't seen Chelsea replicate that. Maybe Abramovich felt that with Shevchenko, but for me at the time, it was a lot of money on a player probably past his best. Yes, he'd won the Ballon d'Or a few seasons previously, but this man was, you know, getting to the wrong side of 30 quickly, whereas you had the best manager in the world at the time at your club. Absolutely ridiculous. So it's one incident that I really look unfavourably upon. I don't know if you can add to that, though, Tony.
Not much. I think you've covered it really nicely there. Again, that sensation of this modern world where the chairman, sometimes, or sporting directors, take preeminence over the manager. And I think it's a negative mode of running a football club, but it does seem to be the modern way. I wonder, though, is there something here to be said for Shevchenko almost being an innocent in this? Couldn't adjust to Chelsea and English football, maybe had lost a bit of pace, which was one of the things that made him so lethal. But, you know, he's just, you know, it's just business. He's a pawn in the game of chess, as it were. And, you know, I just wonder if, as you say, it does tarnish his legacy. But again, only the third Ukrainian to claim the Ballon d'Or, Champions League winner, twice runner-up. It's a heck of a pedigree. And I just think maybe it was the wrong club at the wrong time, and he was an innocent in that. So quickly, your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I'd have to agree with you there. You know, a lot of these transfers, some of the ones that haven't made the cut, some of the ones that people have sent in to us, it's an accident, or they've kind of gone to a club at the wrong time with the wrong manager. You know, Angel Di Maria, what some great listener has put in there, Manchester United flop, but he was played in the wrong style. Louis van Gaal wasn't the right kind of manager for him. So I totally agree with you there, Tony, that it was the wrong club at the wrong time for Shevchenko. He should have probably stayed in Italy. You know, the pace of the game there suited a aging striker. The Premier League's not where you want to be when you're aging with legs and the physicality. It's not the one.
It would be fascinating to see what a prime time Chev could have done in the Premier League. But that's going to be always one for the hypotheticals. Now on to the critical matter of your first selection as the worst signing in Premier League history. Who have you got for us, Jason?
So I've actually gone to the other end of the pitch here, but it's another Chelsea signing. I'm looking at Kepa Arrizabalaga. He's a very, very recent signing. And I know I've done this before where I've kind of jumped the gun and said, you know, Trent Alexander-Arnold should have been in the England 11. And you thought that maybe that was preeminent. But I think the fact that two seasons at Chelsea, he has been ousted by a very aging, you know, almost retirement age goalkeeper in Willy Caballero shows that he is absolutely dreadful. And when he arrived at Chelsea, I was very shocked and confused by the acquisition at the time. You know, world record fee, which is still the world record fee for a goalkeeper at the time, he was arguably the 16th best goalkeeper in La Liga. I mean, that'd be kind of like going for Brighton's goalkeeper for a world record price, you know, Real Madrid picking that up. It was a little bit unthinkable. And, you know, his save percentages were dreadful. He wasn't really good in the air, and his, you know, ability, I'm going to say the swear word, his XG, goals prevented ability, was absolutely dreadful. But maybe Chelsea liked the way that he played. They saw that he was very good at kind of positioning, which is a positive, but also the way that he played out from the back. You know, as a Spanish goalkeeper in the Spanish league, they focus on that play style, which Sarri wanted to replicate, which Pep has brought to Manchester City. But I think they fell into the old English way of thinking with footballers, that he's good at one thing, we can teach him the rest. When, you know, when you look at these players, you need kind of a complete figure. And since his arrival at Chelsea, he has not deviated from the fact that he wasn't good enough at the time. Chelsea have been really shot in defence, and that does go down a little bit to their play style. They are quite aggressive, and they don't have the defenders with the legs and the ability to kind of defend it. But
it starts in goal, doesn't it? The defensive organisation. And you're right to identify, in this modern world, clubs are seeking that visionary keeper who almost, in many ways, operates like an old-style sweeper. And that I get. But if you don't have the ability to do your nuts and bolts job in goal, then in a defence which is nervous and young, then that only amplifies things. I always think back, for instance, to the Gunners and David Seaman at the other end of the world in Manchester United's dynasty, of course, the Great Dane, Schmeichel. It starts from the back, and then the ability from the sticks to command the defenders into positions, but more importantly, to instill confidence. Goalkeeper is possibly one of the most exposed positions in all of sports, and you can be a hero to a zero in seconds. And even the all-time greats, you look at highlight reels and you will see mistakes where they flapped at crosses or led in easy goals, which the fan in the street would save. Of course, we would. And I get all that. But the point is, you can't bank on potential, and least of all in goal, because it is such a critical role. I wonder, based on that, you were saying maybe not even in the top 10 of La Liga kind of goalkeepers at that stage. What are Chelsea's scouting elements doing? Because, as I say, I always advocate that the manager must be, or had ought to be at least, the overseer of the transfers and instill the techniques and the tactics that obviously is his focus. But they can't be at every single game and manage a club. So they rely on scout reports, and these days, obviously, videos. But surely, there must have been something amiss in the scouting procedure to take a punt at that level, at that world record fee.
I think the problem that Chelsea had was they didn't get their optimum transfer targets. So it was kind of rumoured at the time, and I think it's basically good knowledge that Jan Oblak from Atletico Madrid was their prime target. Andre Onana from Ajax was also kind of up there as one of the best, and I think he'd be a fantastic player to come in now if they were to do it. But at the time, Chelsea had just lost their best goalkeeper, Thibaut Courtois, to Real Madrid, you know, and they probably panicked. They thought, oh God, we're not getting our best signing. We don't want to risk it on this person because he's playing in the Dutch league. This guy's playing in La Liga. He's quite good quality. But yeah, it does make you question what was going on. And there was a lot of questionable signings under Sarri. The play style wasn't great. So maybe if it was a Sarri signing, you know, maybe somebody that he kind of came into the club with and said, let's go for him, then maybe the blame lies there. But I think you're right there, Tony, that these big clubs do have a network of systems. And if you'd looked at him, and if you look at the problems that are persisting at Chelsea now, it's set pieces, it's aerial duels, it's all these things that Kepa was never going to be good at because he's quite a slight goalkeeper. So since his arrival, as I said, Chelsea have been shoddy up and down. But I think what was also a big problem was Chelsea obviously hadn't done their homework with the fact that he's not an agreeable character. And we saw this in the Carabao Cup final. He had a huge argument. He obviously thought that he wasn't Kepa the keeper. He thought he was Kepa the manager because he said, no, I'm going to stay on the pitch. And it was
It was farcical scenes, wasn't it?
It was dreadful to see. And I don't know why Chelsea didn't do something more about it. I don't know why people didn't drag him off the pitch, because Caballero knew how to play against his former teammates. He probably knew where people were going to be shooting. It's a poor quality signing with a poor attitude. And I can just throw out some of the numbers there as well. Through his time in the Premier League, at one point he had one of the worst save percentages in Europe. Not just in the Premier League, in Europe. He was like 156th out of, let's say, 180 goalkeepers. It was absolutely abysmal. He's been embarrassing with kind of shots in the box saving. As I said, their poor attitude, but also he has not saved many goals at all. Again, I'm going to throw it to the XG data, but he's conceded 12 more goals than he should have over the course of the season. When you compare that to the likes of Alisson or even Tottenham's fantastic goalkeeper, Lloris, who prevented 9 goals this season, that's what you want from a world-class goalkeeper. Letting in 12 more is not even below average. That's appalling. That is, you know, somebody who shouldn't be at the top flight. And I think what's worst of all for Chelsea is they now have to offload him with the fact that everybody knows that he isn't good enough and that he has a poor attitude. So it's going to be one of the most expensive debacles of all time because of the fact that they're going to have to get rid of him at a cut price only 2 years into his contract. So for me, it's kind of a mixture of the fact that he's probably cost the club as well, potentially in games, but also definitely 2 cup finals. Because the Carabao Cup final, he cost the team with mentality. Like you said there, players lose their confidence. They think, I can't trust this guy. And he's a bit, you know, all over the place. We can't trust him with his poor attitude. And then in this recent FA Cup final, Chelsea couldn't field their first goalkeeper because he just wasn't good enough. They had to play a veteran, Willie Caballero. So for me, that is why it has to be the worst transfer of all time because it's cost Chelsea big time and it will cost them for a few more seasons until they can get rid of him.
No, listen, I think you made some really, really good points there. But as we do say, even the greats sometimes make errors when it comes to transfers. There are so many imponderables, the ability to or integrate into a team and its culture. This style that is unique to the Premier League sometimes takes some adjustments. So there are reasons and whys and wherefores behind all of these failures. I'm going to bring on now to another Chelsea flop, though. And he's been mentioned several times already tonight, not least across social media. But I'm going to go for Torres, who was sensational before joining Chelsea. Burst onto the scene incredibly young at Atletico Madrid, and in 214 appearances, he netted 82 goals, moving to Liverpool, when in 102 appearances, he claimed over 65 goals. He became, in that Liverpool run, the fastest Liverpool player to get to 50 goals, a record I think surpassed now by Salah. But since leaving Liverpool, he joined Chelsea, as we've discussed, only playing there from 2011 to 2015. Over 100 appearances, 110, just 20 goals. Since leaving Liverpool, he's now retired. He retired in 2019 out in China. He's only scored 48 goals in his last 8 seasons. For a man who was so deadly, had the whole combination, pace, acceleration, an eye for a goal, left foot, right foot, even reasonable in the air. On his day in that Liverpool time, he was quite simply sensational. Chelsea paid the big bucks that form indicated was necessary. They came to the bridge in 2011, leaving, as I say, 2015, only 20 goals in over 100 appearances. Never even looked the same man. Just didn't look happy in his time at Chelsea and quite simply was not able to replicate the kind of form that made him one of the most famed and one of the most feared strikers in all of Europe and indeed all of world football in that earlier run. So sad to compare and contrast his abilities bursting onto the scene so young at Atletico Madrid, what he achieved at Liverpool, and then since 2 different careers. Very sad, but a $50 million price tag, again, on form, on paper, looked like you can't fault that dollar, but the performance relative to the pounds paid, simply a non-favourable ratio from a Blues perspective. The name Torres has come up quite a few times already tonight. He's my choice for the biggest flop in Premier League transfer history. Jason, your quick thoughts on Torres?
Looking at it from, you know, playing a little bit of a devil's advocate here, I'm not going to say that he was a good signing, but He did win the Champions League with Chelsea. He did win the FA Cup. He did win the Europa League. So he did win. He did add to his, you know, very full to the brim honours cage. But what I would say is there is a story, I think, and I think it is true, the reason why Torres flopped like he did. So he went to Liverpool a year or just a few months after the Euro 2008. And what happened with him there was he had a very bad injury, and he could either choose to have an operation, but that would mean that he'd have to sit out the World Cup 2010. He had to decide whether he was going to play at the World Cup, the pinnacle of football, or if he was going to extend his career by a few more years and have this operation. So he chose for the World Cup. He played it. He got a little bit more injured. But I don't blame him at all. I think El Nino actually made the right decision there. You're only going to get one or two attempts at a World Cup, but the chance at a club career, there's every season, basically, isn't there? Mm-hmm. So I don't blame his decision. What I do blame, again, it's Chelsea, the decision-making. They saw Torres as a Drogba replacement. They brought him in, they spent big money, but they didn't realise about this leg injury. And it was also, you know, at a time where Drogba was coming out the side and they really did need a replacement. They couldn't find anybody else. In fact, their best target was going to be Sergio Aguero, but they faltered on him because John Terry said he's not good enough for the Premier League. I mean, John Terry, he's a Chelsea legend, but my goodness, that's going to be a costly kind of decision there for the Blues. So in terms of it, Torres, they should have known that he had an injury problem, that he didn't have this surgery. And, you know, it's no surprise that he lost his pace. He probably lost confidence as well because he knew that his body was going to falter a little bit. It's not Torres's fault. I don't blame him too much. But what I will agree with is he's probably one of the biggest flops ever because of that money. And that money kind of gave him, you know, big things that he had to live up to. I would ask to you, Tony, do you think as well part of the problem with Torres wasn't just the injuries, but that huge price tag at a time where he was a little bit worried about his body? Do you think that added a bit too much pressure?
I think it's one of those that strikers need goals. And the longer that they go without getting that first goal, the bigger the pressure becomes, because it's what everybody focuses in on and talks about, and it becomes amplified. But, you know, let's not forget how a quality career, like you say, he's won titles everywhere he's played. He's also Spain's third highest top scorer all time with 38 goals from 110 caps. And what he's won with Spain in this golden era of Spanish football is sensational. Won the Euros 2008 and also back-to-back then in 2012. Golden boot winner in the Euro 2012. And as you say, despite not necessarily being fully fit, represented Spain at the 2010 World Cup and claimed a title there with them. So, you know, it's a stellar career. I think you're right to identify the pressure component, but I think you are absolutely correct when you explain the nature of that injury and then the direct correlation between the pre-injured Torres and the post-injured Torres. Not to put it in the same analogue, but you could have put another maybe Premier League flop in this category, maybe a Michael Owen when he went to Newcastle, for instance. Actually didn't do bad for Real Madrid. People forget he was actually not a bad player in the El Galaxy league there. But my point with regard to the analogue with Michael Owen is that Torres, what made him so deadly was his searing pace. It was frightening. And to lose that, as he did, he wasn't able, maybe in the way that Ronaldo's been so supreme in evolving and adapting his game, to have taken into account a changing body. And, you know, again, the stats don't lie, Jason. Before 2010, that World Cup and then that injury, he had 82 goals in 214 appearances for Atletico Madrid, 65 goals in 102 games for Liverpool, as I say, becoming at that time the quickest to 50 goals for Liverpool in their history. After that, it's literally 48 goals in 8 seasons, a paltry return in goals to game ratio. We are talking a career definable in 2 phases. And that injury, I think, is almost the pivot upon which they shifted. So again, as you rightly identify, nobody could ever blame an individual for fighting to go to a World Cup. But maybe now you'd be fascinated to ask of him whether in hindsight he might have made a different choice, prolonged his career, and who knows. But we are well in the world of speculation and hypotheticals there. Before we move on to change tone and delve into what we consider our all-time favourite transfers or best, one of the awesome social media interactions cited a name that's probably not on the top of everybody's list, but Ali Dia. I just love this. What a tale. And this is, again, we've got to consider now how important stats and data analysis is, but more critically, doing the due diligence. I mean, this is absolutely borderline farcical. Essentially, Graeme Souness signed him. He was a semi-pro, but I don't know whether it was an agent or a representative or whatever it was, or, you know, how these things come together. Goodness only knows. But essentially, somebody led Graeme Souness to believe that Ali Dia was a cousin of the all-time great George Weah and was plying his trade and is worth a punt. So basically on a erroneous nod and a wink, he brought them in to Southampton. I think he played one game. I think he actually got substituted in that game. But let's put this into context. He was a semi-professional footballer who is then thrust into Premier League activity. I mean, it's kind of the dream of every armchair fan, but it's also absolutely farcical. It's unbelievably to almost consider that this happened in the Premier League era. And I would say I can't imagine that ever happening now. Just quickly, your thoughts on the tale that is true on Ali Dia.
Ali Dia, he's probably proud of himself for that achievement there. I love the story. It seems almost like something you'd do with your mates at university. Apparently, the person Absolutely. That played George Weah was one of his fellow uni students. So Dia actually went on to get, I think it was a master's or something, of business. So he did his MBA. But it just makes me laugh. You know, you probably have a mental image of maybe some squiffy university student, maybe thought, oh, it'd be a right joke to ring up Southampton, and then it just happened. What confuses me a little bit, though, is they obviously must have had warm-up matches, they must have had a bit of pre-game training, and Souness must have made the decision. You know, it's not all Dia and his friend's fault for misleading him. He must have gone, oh yeah, he looks good. Right, we'll put him out there. We'll confuse the opposition because of this unknown person. A little bit of the blame, or maybe a lot of the blame, has to go to Souness there, because yes, he was a bit misled, and maybe he wasn't au fait with the times there. But he must have looked at him and gone, oh yeah, no, he's good enough. I mean, Letiz said about the match, Matt Letizia, you know, one of the Southampton greats, who said he ran round the pitch like Bambi on ice. Well, embarrassing to watch. And it just makes you think, was he really good in training? Maybe Ali Dia's like a lot of these pro footballers who are better in training than on the pitch. And maybe the occasion got to him. Maybe Ali Dia was just a gem that needed Graeme Souness to take him under his wing. What an alternate history that would be, eh?
Absolutely. And it's a great, surreal tale, a true story. We've uncovered there some of what we consider the biggest flops in Premier League transfer history. And I know you listening have got your views. Tweet them in. Who have we missed? Tweet at Verum Sport and continue to engage. Remember, as always, this is your show. Every single bit as much as it is as. But now moving on to the more positive side of things, because there's been some supremely good transfer business in the 25 plus years of Premier League history. And again, going to introduce Graham Griffin's choice in this category. A reminder, check out the local football show each and every Tuesday on 92.6 FM to hear from the voice of the Saints, Graham Griffin, and delve into all things local football, not least, of course, the mighty Saints. But saintly, maybe not, but certainly special. So good, in fact, they named him twice. JJ Okocha is Graham Griffin's choice of best transfer in Premier League history. He made 124 appearances for Bolton, only scoring 14 goals, but each one of those a showreel, including, of course, the goal of the season from the 2002 campaign against West Ham, a goal which was instrumental in keeping the Trotters in the Premier League. JJ Okocha, so good. They named him twice. He came from Paris Saint-Germain to Bolton and is Graham Griffin's shout for the best Premier League transfer. I'm not sure about the best, but I would certainly put him in the category most entertaining. But Jason, your thoughts on JJ Okocha?
I mean, the fact that he was the mentor and arguably one of the architects of a young Ronaldinho just says it all. The skill, the ability of JJ Okocha, he was unreal. And like you said there, maybe not one of the best transfers in terms of abilities, but maybe one of the best because of the entertainment value. Whenever he entered the pitch, you just knew something exciting was going to happen. He didn't have to score a lot of goals, but the ones that he did were sumptuous, they're amazing and out of this world. And I think, you know, kind of to end with his time at Bolton, you know, it didn't end in the best of ways, but I think he had a very poignant comment in 2012. So that was a long while after he left, but he actually explained that he was quite disappointed with the fact of how the club was run post his departure. He said that he feels that, you know, his time at the club was actually a bit of a waste of time because the club hadn't invested and improved on the foundations he made then. I do have to agree there. And I also have to kind of ask the question of maybe Bolton and their ambitions. You know, Sam Allardyce revolutionised that club. He really turned things around. And the fact that they let him go, that at times they didn't stick to maybe the core foundations that Big Sam had left there as well. And obviously he tried to do it at other clubs, at Newcastle and whatnot. He's shown his quality at keeping clubs up. Yes, the football's boring, but sometimes you do have to ask with the likes of Burnley as well. I think Burnley understand that their success is predicated on Dyche, and they don't get too far ahead of themselves and think, right, we're going to sack him because we could play beautiful continental football. That's not Burnley, realistically, at the end of the day. And I think Bolton needed to understand that. I totally agree with Graham there that Okocha was one of the greats in the Premier League. I always used to rush to buy him in the FIFAs, you know, FIFA 2002, 2003, 2004. You'd always put him on the free kicks as well. But it's kind of sad as well. I do have to agree with Okocha that his legacy at Bolton, he hasn't ruined it. You know, he's an all-time great. But the club there should have built upon it. He was a world-class player, probably, and I don't mean to insult Bolton here, but well beyond their means. The Trotters really kind of did well there. And the fact that they didn't build upon that is very sad. And it saddens me that JJ kind of feels let down.
Yeah, I think you made some really interesting points then. It's a fascinating and poignant quote from JJ that he's made there. One thing I would say, certainly for me, one of the most entertaining footballers I've ever witnessed. It's just a showreel of the silky skills that he's got, and not necessarily a great scorer, but certainly one of those scorers of great goals. As I mentioned, 2002 goal of the season winner. But setting aside all the deficiencies, perhaps, from on high at Bolton, on building upon the foundations laid there, let's not deviate from the context, which maybe actually elevates JJ, and maybe puts him certainly in the firm category of one of the great acquisitions. And that is because of the fact that he is at a Bolton, always fighting for their lives. They don't have the squad depth to match some of the big guns. So I'm not insinuating that Bolton were a one-man JJ team, but what I would say is it makes it challenging for him to shine when sometimes you are chasing a game and sometimes teams can become much more comfortable to not only man mark, but almost two men on JJ. So good, they named him twice, was oftentimes able to overcome that. But I would suggest, I'd like your take on it before we move on, that the skill he demonstrated in that challenging context really does elevate the legacy of Okocha.
The best players of all time are always remembered because they won things. And, you know, Matt Le Tissier, somebody that I mentioned a little bit earlier, kind of with the Ali Dears story, he'll always be revered in Southampton. And a lot of people kind of ask, well, he could have moved to Man United, this and that. And there's a lot to be said of the Shearers, he was at two clubs, but he basically spent his best years at Newcastle. He could have gone on to bigger and better things. And yeah, you do have to question maybe their hunger, their desire, but also you have to give them credit for loyalty. And JJ Okocha, he probably could have gone to a bigger club, a better kind of setup. He'd moved from PSG to Bolton. You know, at the time, they weren't the great club that they were now, but they were still pushing for things in France. You know, they were a European Cup winner at the time that he was there. And you know, it does make you question whether he can be regarded as a Premier League all-time great with the lack of goals. As you said there, he was marked out of a lot of matches. But if he's not at a top club, does that always mean that you're not going to be considered there? I mean, I would put it back to you that Shearer was obviously one of the greats, but he wasn't at a great club. And people contextualise that he did magnificent things at that club, but then he did have a Premier League medal, which JJ Okocha never had. So maybe that's the thing that separates Shearer from the likes of JJ Okocha. But does that always discount you? I'm not sure. It's a very good argument.
It truly is, and I really would value your take on this. I know you've got many, many opinions. Tweet us at Verum Sport. Keep involved. In terms of JJ Okocha, before we move things forwards, for me, he is in a slightly different category, and that's an entertainer. And we talked in the business of sports chat last time. At the end of the day, people are paying their money to be entertained, and he offered that each and every single week. Whether he's not necessarily going to bag a goal, you could put your money on that JJ will give you something in that game that you're going to be gaping over, that you're going to then be talking about for weeks with your friends, because he had that kind of a gift. In a similar vein, maybe in a literally almost like-for-like context, maybe Janinho in a similar period at Middlesbrough, again, another entertainer, another gem, but without necessarily many winning medals, certainly from the Middlesbrough perspective. Granted, he does have a World Cup winning medal, this Janinho. But my point is to compare there. Really, for me, there are a certain brand of footballer, JJ certainly being preeminent amongst them, Janinho, and I would even argue, like you've already referenced, Matthew Le Tissier, for instance, who are just artists in many ways. They're entertainers, enigmatic, and as to whether they would necessarily be able to mould their flair into a more championship-focused team is another imponderable that we'll never know. But JJ seriously was that good. He was worth two names, and he's been a big presence here tonight. And Graham Griffin, so good, we call him Double G, is a great shout. So appreciate your work, Graham. And again, do check out Graham on the Tuesday local football show. But moving on now, a man who, in anybody's estimation, is an all-time great. A man who I know is going to be well up there in your all-time list of all-time footballers. I'm talking about Jason. Stage is yours to introduce the legend that is your next take on the best transfer in Premier League history?
You've introduced it here. Now, I don't want to be too Arsenal-centric here, you know, or on Verulam Sport, and I value so many players of different teams, and I tried to be as objective as possible. But when you're talking about best transfers, best players, best people in the Premier League, I think objectively people can agree that Thierry Henry is one of the greatest ever of all time. And I argue that, you know, it's not just quality, but value on price. £11 million at the time was a little bit of money. But in terms of the current context of money banded around, £11 million has to be one of the best value signings ever.
And just quickly, Jason, sorry to cut your flow there, but it was certainly peak form Wenger, wasn't it, to recognise that gem, because he came from Monaco. The transfer itself at 11 million was, I believe, from Juve, where he didn't exactly bathe himself in glory, and he was almost very much a winger that Wenger seemed to unearth. And then right man, right place, right time syndrome really came to the fore. And I know you're going to elaborate on that. But just briefly, your thoughts on the important role of Wenger at that time, identifying that talent that is Henry and getting it at a cheapest chips rate in relative terms.
It's unarguable, and it's kind of referenced plenty of times with that signing there. Henry was a player that was a bit disheartened with what had happened at Juventus, and a lot of people kind of said he was a flop or a failure there, and he did all right, but he wasn't amazing. He didn't set the world on light like he did at Arsenal. But Wenger had worked with Henry at Monaco, and obviously he knew him as well through his French connections, and he probably observed him at Juventus. Undoubtedly, Tony, you're 100% right. If Wenger hadn't been at Arsenal, maybe at a different club, Wenger would have taken him there, because he was almost like another son of his. We saw it with George Weah, who went on to win a World Ballon d'Or with Wenger's kind of stewardship, and Weah always kind of cites Wenger for that as well. So Wenger's role in so many players' lives cannot be understated. But in terms of Henry, I would say that, like Prince, I would say that I was dreaming when I wrote this, because, you know, we're talking about 1999, when he came into the club. He was the king of Arsenal, but he didn't have a regal kind of start at all. And people kind of really questioned the transfer at the time. It took him 8 games to actually get a goal. And kind of what we're talking about a little bit earlier with Torres, people like that, that can knock somebody's confidence. But again, Wenger was instrumental in kind of saying to Henry, I've seen what you're good at, your abilities, this and that. So even though it took him 8 games to register, his first season was all right. But it was after that initial season, he had an amazing Euros in the 2000s, and then the artisan shone through. We talked about entertainers there with JJ Okocha. Henry was not just a brilliant footballer, but he was an entertainer as well. And I think that 2000-2001 season was the breakthrough that we saw what Henry was about. He scored that stunning half volley against Manchester United. I'm not sure if you remember that one, Tony, but it was against Fabian Barthez. And
Jason, like I say, I can't fault you in the least, not in the least, for introducing Henry to this. You know, I mean, the stats are phenomenal, aren't they? Arsenal's all-time top scorer with, I think, 228 goals in all competitions. He was a Premier League Golden Boot winner on 4 occasions. Two FA Cups, 2 Premier League titles. Truly one of the all-time great signings. No questions about it. 03-04, maybe when he was perhaps at the peak of tremendous powers, runner-up in FIFA's World Player of the Year. I mean, I know from a Gunners perspective, he's never going to be forgotten. But quite simply, objectively, he lit up the Premier League, didn't he?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of it, I mean, you could argue that 02-03 was his best season, because that was the season where he's the only player in history to score and assist more than 20 goals in a season. I mean, that is absolutely ridiculous. That is 40 plus goal contributions from one single player. I would have to say his crowning moment, and the reason why his legend will live on forever until probably a team will match this, but that 03-04 unbeaten season. He was unplayable, unbeatable, and unbelievable. He had 39 goals in all competitions, but also kind of bringing my stats to the fore once again. This was obviously when stats were in their infancy, but Stats Bomb have thankfully gone back and looked at all the data, and people should really check this out. They've done it with Messi as well. They release kind of fun little projects like this, and they've sat and watched all of the 03-04 games, and the owner of Stats Bomb is actually an Arsenal fan, so that's probably why they've undertook this project. But he had monstrous data. We're talking about absolutely stratospheric. His dribbling of 3.6 completed per 90 is in the 99th percentile of all time in terms of collected data. So let's say the last 15 years or so. That's up there with Messi. That's up there with some of the greatest dribblers of all time. And for a striker, he had a ridiculous expected assist of 0.26 per 90. That's something that you'd see from Mesut Ozil at his peak. These are strange numbers to see from a player that's playing up there and always scoring goals. And then his XG per 90 was a ridiculous 0.52. He was almost guaranteed a goal every other game, and he scored even more than that. And like you said there, 2005, we saw him break the top goal scorer record at Arsenal, something that had stood since Ian Wright, where he famously took off the just done it kind of shirt, which was another great moment. He also beat Cliff Baston's league goals record, but he also had 100 league goals at Highbury, which I think is one of the only players to actually do it at one club stadium, along with Aguero and I think Rooney as well. You know, ridiculous kind of stuff there.
One of the things I do think is great about him, obviously what's brought him to the table here, is we're talking Premier League acquisitions, both positive and negative, and Henry certainly is a positive acquisition. But, you know, we've talked about some players who maybe tarnished their legacy in latter career. Obviously, he will firmly and always be a Premier League legend, embedded for all time and all history in any way of looking at things as an Arsenal legend. But what he then achieved with Barcelona was really rather impressive too. Maybe not necessarily at the peak of his powers, but 35 goals in 80 games for the Catalan greats. And he achieved the treble with Barcelona, League Cup, and of course, Champions League too. Plus, 51 goals in 123 games for France. And, you know, it's quite astonishing. A World Cup winner in 98, in France, so that must have been emotional, and Euro 2000 as well. So just an iconic career. He really is an all-time great, and I know we use that phrase all the time, but for Henry, it is so, so fair. But just quickly, Jason, your thoughts on his post-Arsenal career and the fact that it maybe not quite as stellar, but certainly was very successful indeed.
Yeah, I think post-2005, basically, he didn't lift another cup with Arsenal. And when he left in 2007 for Barcelona, he broke a lot of our hearts. You know, I was sad. It was a heartbreaking end to the tale. And I think what was most saddening was that 06-07, he was sidelined from February. So we didn't give a proper send-off, or we thought that at the time. And obviously, he went on for greatness at Barcelona. He said that he learned so much from Pep Guardiola, which is fascinating, you know, to think that one of the best players of all time could still improve himself. And yes, obviously, he didn't score a lot of goals, but he got that elusive Champions League that he'd wanted for so, so long. And he deserved it. You know, he gave some of his best years for Arsenal. He created the modern day club, and I don't begrudge him at all. And then he set the MLS alight. He probably brought a lot of fans over to American football for the first time, which is fantastic. It's growing as a sport. But I mentioned there that he didn't seem to have that send-off. But this again is why I say he's one of the best transfers of all time, because the narrative's there. 2011, we saw the King return to the Emirates for one last grand send-off, and people knew that this was going to be the last time. He scored a winning FA Cup goal against your Leeds, but I'm sure you don't begrudge that, seeing the legend score. And then, in a fairy tale final game for the club, he scored the winner against Sunderland. You know, these weren't amazing games. They didn't win a title, but he scored two goals in a few games for Arsenal. He scored winners. He was back to being the King, and he left the goal. He added two more, so he ended with 2-2-8. So he completed the story. You know, it was kind of one of those things. It'd be a bit like Game of Thrones actually getting a good ending. The writers come back and actually finish it off. This was a story that was properly completed, and probably in the most dramatic and beautiful fashion as well. So data-wise, money-wise, and the story too of Henry, he has to be the best transfer ever. It's the complete footballing tale, rags to riches, numbers, but the narrative to make it a grand old tale for the ages. I think that, for me, is why he is... Thierry is the best there, Tony.
Totally love it. Totally can't fault you there. But I'm going to introduce another man who is Le King. And for me, this is also the best transfer in Premier League history. And personally, and I know many Leeds fans would agree with me, the worst signing in Premier League history, the worst bit of business. He wasn't actually a star at Leeds, only playing there for a season and a half or so. But when he was there, he 28 games, 9 goals for Leeds, but he was an assist merchant, helping Lee Chapman fire in many a goal as Leeds became the last winner of the first division. Remember, kids, there was football before the Premier League. Slight bit of acrimony between him and manager Howard Wilkinson. Quick aside, Howard Wilkinson, the last English manager to hold aloft the top title in the top division in football. Bit of a falling out there. And he almost kind of made it clear that he wanted to move out, and fair enough. But 1.2 million. I know in those days, you know, a fair sum. But in modern context, absolutely paltry. And even in those days, I would argue, small fry. Because I know it's easy in hindsight, but good God, what a transition that was. Leeds the following season, the first inaugural season of the Premier League, went from champs to chumps and finished only, I think, one place above the relegation zone. Not saying that it was all because Cantona wasn't there, but also, I don't believe in coincidences. And it's surely no coincidence that began the era of dominance that is the Fergie years. He then won the league with Man United 4 occasions, and that first one was indeed the inaugural Premier League campaign. He was Le King, playing with such a strut, such a style, such a charisma that was almost unique. It's not a matter of stats when it comes to Cantona, but it is impressive. For Manchester United, 64 goals in 143 games. But it was his charisma, his leadership, his ability to change and influence a game that was almost unique. And we've been talking throughout this wonderful debate about entertainers. I mean, he was born to entertain. I will never forget that goal he scored, I think, against Sunderland, having danced past a few players on the halfway. He chips the Sunderland keeper and quite simply turns, lifts the collar, and is the King. And it is just a moment of glory that he lived and embodied. And yeah, there have been flashier goals and there have been flashier goal celebrations, but very few as potent as that. You know, the guy is just an all-time great. And like I say, he was the artist and the artisan that became the era of Man United dominance, to which they will be eternally grateful. Perhaps accordingly, he was actually voted by Inside United magazine as the greatest all-time Man U player. When you think of all the greats they've had through the years, Best, Charlton, etc., etc. Dennis Law, Bobby Robson, Brian Robson. The lists are many and varied, but it is Le King Cantona who was voted their greatest all-time player. He was immortalized in the inaugural Premier League Hall of Fame in 2002. In 2003, in the 10 seasons of the Premier League award, he was actually voted the best overseas player of the decade. And in 2004, another all-time great, Pelé, put him in a list of 100 players who are the greatest living players. Just an absolute litany of success. As with all mercurial geniuses, there are those moments of madness, and who can forget that season when he was banned, I think, for 8 months, when he leapt into the crowd, assaulting, I think it was a Crystal Palace spectator, presumably giving the king grief. But even this moment just served as an opportunity for the great man to entertain us all with one of the most oblique quotes of all time, when he uttered, "When the seagulls follow the trailer, they know there will be sardines." Thank you, Monsieur Eric. I'm fully with you there. But the point of the matter is this. I don't want to paint glory on that moment of madness, but it was a glorious campaign and just seasons of greatness at Old Trafford. And if you think Premier League dominance, it's still Man United, the team that springs to your mind. I think you could make the case that it was Monsieur Cantona who made that all possible. 1.2 million. Money immensely well spent. Your thoughts on the king?
Yeah, I think you're right there. To call him the king, he's definitely royalty, and he's up there with Henri for all kinds of different reasons as well. I love the stories of his special relationship with Ferguson, you know, the grand master of keeping people in line. But with Eric, he knew he was special, he knew he was a maverick, and he knew that he had to treat him differently. And he served Ferguson so well in kind of that commitment to treating him a little bit different, but getting the best out of him. I have to totally agree with you. I believe that Cantona was the catalyst for Man United. You know, they won their first Premier League because of him. And what I would say as well was, Cantona cannot just be given the credit for Man United, but arguably the whole of the Premier League then started catching up with Ferguson. This was a British football setup that had been starved of European football due to the ban. Mm-hmm. The terrible kind of incident with Liverpool meant that British teams were not allowed to play in Europe, and this meant that for one reason or another, teams didn't want to adapt. And Cantona was one of these players that British people said, "Oh no, he'll never do well." And it's kind of the same arguments with, you know, David Silva when he came, when Pep Guardiola came. They'll never do well in English football. Well, they've shown it differently. He didn't conform to convention.
I don't believe in coincidence, right?
Yeah.
I do believe in influence. And just check out that again. He wasn't necessarily a stellar star at Leeds in that championship-winning team. Only 9 goals, oh, actually only 3 goals in 15 games that season. But he was chalking up so many for Lee Chapman. But then to move to Man U and help instrumentally as he was in that first Premier League title, and notice the distinction with Leeds literally hovering, I think, only one place above relegation. Again, I don't want to oversimplify. I know there's a lot of other factors at play, but there's a very strong common denominator in that kind of juxtaposition, isn't there?
Yeah, no, I totally have to agree with you there. I think post, Cantona, Leeds didn't really recover. And I think it was a little bit of an embarrassment for the club as well. I suppose, you know, my kind of finishing comments were, I think people underestimate how important he was. And probably behind Henri, I'd have to put Cantona up there as the best transfer of all time. because he revolutionised club football, you know, in Britain. He was the catalyst for change to bring them up to date. And again, like you said, there's no coincidence, but obviously he wasn't at the club at the time, but Man United's first European triumph for a long, long time was just the season after he left. And he left them in a very, very strong position. Arguably, they probably would have won it more easily, maybe less dramatically, if he was still there. But he laid the foundations, and Cantona cannot be underestimated. I think, though, I'd like to finish maybe my point on Cantona. Do you remember him at Leeds, Tony? Do you have fond memories, and maybe negative ones as well, kind of begrudging Leeds letting him go after seeing him light up the league in person?
Great question. I remember him well, actually. Yeah, you know what? He actually was almost damaged goods. He's always had this kind of temperamental character and fell out with lots of French international managers. And it was Platini who kind of tried to get him back to England, to get him back into football, because he fell out big style with, I think it was Nîmes before he joined Leeds. He had a trial at Sheffield Wednesday, Trevor Sinclair, the first actual £1 million footballer in the UK, or Trevor Francis, sorry, didn't quite see him fitting into English football. So it could have been a whole different story had Sheffield Wednesday made that decision. He then joined Leeds, and he was just always one of those guys. You could even see it back in those days where he just took control of a game. And as I say, not necessarily prolific at Leeds, but certainly influential. And I know Lee Chapman was delighted with his partnership with Monsieur Cantona, because he always had an eye for a pass and great, great vision. And for me, he is a visionary. And as I say, if you look at value for money of what Manu became, I'm not insinuating that that would have been the Leeds' trajectory. One could, but it's too speculative. But I'm simply stating, for 1.2 million from then to what Manu are, I don't think it would have been possible without Eric Cantona. And for that reason, he is seminal. As long as there is a Premier League, the name Eric Cantona will be synonymous with it. And I think that's a wonderful, wonderful thing. And I tell you what, it's been a wonderful, wonderful thing to enjoy your company as always, The Machine, Jason McKenna. As always, I want to thank you for listening and for giving us this great topic. Make sure you're with us next week on 92.6 FM, 6 through 7, where once again we'll be debating, dissecting and analysing another sporting topic, always of your choosing. But for now, keep well, keep safe, keep involved. Thanks for listening.